Hey, this is Scott. On the last episode, I mentioned a unique and nonprofit tech conference in Florida called Code on the Beach, coming up here August 8th through the 10th. I was fortunate enough to keynote last year, and I can tell you from experience, you should check it out. But you better hurry. Registration for Code on the Beach is almost over, but you can visit www.codeonthebeach.com to register today, and Hansel Minutes listeners get a $50 off coupon with the code Hanselman. If you do happen to miss it this year, put a reminder on your calendar for next year because it is an annual event. They'll be back summer 2015. Here's a little tip, though. They're planning a similar event on a cruise ship to the Bahamas, February, called Code on the Sea. So check out codeonthebeach.com and codeonthesea.com to learn more about both conferences.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 431. In this episode, Scott talks with Dr. Stephen John Russell about the Bionic Pancreas Study.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we've got Dr. Stephen J. Russell on the phone from bionicpancreas.org. You have all been in the news a lot lately. There's been some really exciting stuff going on around type 1 diabetics and some of the work that's happening. Can you give us an overview about what it means to have a bionic pancreas?
Well, our goal with the bionic pancreas is to do two things, really. One, to get better blood glucose control than people can consistently get with the current tools that we have available by providing this new tool called a bionic pancreas, and at the same time to really reduce the amount of work it takes to manage diabetes. So the system is one that takes full advantage of several technologies that have been available separately for a number of years, continuous glucose monitoring, insulin pumps, and combine those along with a dosing algorithm that takes the information from the continuous glucose monitor and makes decisions every 5 minutes about how much insulin and or glucagon to either lower or raise the blood glucose respectively to give. And because it's an automated process that happens every 5 minutes, it's able to continue to make those decisions, make many more decisions on a daily basis than somebody could possibly do on their own. And as a consequence, it achieves better blood glucose control with less low blood sugars.
So I'm a diabetic, of course. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I have worn an insulin pump for the last 15 years, 24 hours a day, for maybe listeners who aren't familiar with this. And this is replaced what we call MDI, multiple daily injections. I used to check my blood sugar with a finger prick 8 to 10 times a day, and then take 3, 4, 5, 6 manual shots a day, and then switched over to a continuous glucose meter that would tell me roughly what my blood sugar is every 5 minutes. And then I have to make all those decisions myself. I am always thinking about my pump. I'm always thinking about the past and how much insulin is in me currently and all those kinds of things. They teach us in diabetes class and diabetes training, you know, all these kinds of algorithms. But most diabetics that have been diabetic for many years, like myself, are going on gut. But you've really broken this down into straight math, right?
Well, I haven't. My collaborators, the engineering collaborators.
Right, you
have.
All.
So, yes, as a group, I guess we have. So my engineering collaborators are Ed Damiano and Firas El-Khatib. And Ed was an applied mathematician, was working on fluid dynamics when his son got type 1 diabetes. And so that initiated a shift for him in emphasis. And his graduate student at the time was very talented but not particularly interested in the kind of work that he was doing, and so he was easily persuaded to shift over to control theory. Mm-hmm. So they worked on using control theory, using some of Ed's insights from managing diabetes for his son day to day, and came up with a general structure for the control algorithm which has been refined quite a bit over the years, but was the basis for the initial studies that they did in animals. And then I met them in 2006, and we brought it into the human realm. And we've been working together ever since. And the system really has acquired ever more sophistication as we've gone on and discovered problems that we needed to fix and circumstances that needed new solutions. And now I think we have a tremendously robust system that requires a bare minimum of information about the person with diabetes to start with, and that is just their weight. Mm-hmm. And then it requires frequent blood glucose information from the continuous glucose monitor. Mm-hmm. And it adapts over time to the insulin needs of that individual and remarkably provides excellent blood glucose control starting with those very minimal bits of information. It doesn't need any information about the insulin regimen that the person has been taking beforehand.
Interesting. I've heard some disturbing reports that a lot of diabetics that use pumps fail to change their default settings. And a lot of people are out there with basically pumps that are shipped the way they ship from the factory.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me very much. I think that one of the reasons we wanted to avoid using the information about the insulin regimen was that it could just be flat wrong, as you point out. Mm-hmm. But another reason is that even if the insulin regimen was fairly reasonable, it's a moving target. People aren't the same from day to day, and certainly not from week to week or month to month. You know, during development, when kids go from the pre-adolescent to puberty, their insulin requirements rocket upwards and they get very much higher. Mm-hmm. And then they drop again once they finish their growth spurt and go into adulthood. People's insulin requirements change tremendously based on how active they are, how much exercise they're getting, what kind of diet they have. And we really wanted a system that could robustly adapt to those changes on a time scale that would allow it to deal with realistic changes in the insulin needs of somebody over time. And so this system does that. It does most of its adaptation within the first 18 hours when you put it on a new person. Mm-hmm. And so it can then adjust if that person's insulin needs change. It can adjust on that same kind of time scale. And we think that's fast enough to deal with most physiologic changes that would happen over somebody's lifetime.
Well, then there's also changes day to day. If someone has the flu or someone is starting to develop slow digestion or stomach paralysis, maybe insulin is going bad if they've had it out in the
Absolutely.
Heat. How would it deal with situations like that?
Well, you know, its shortest time scale is, of course, the every 5 minute time scale. So regardless of its adapted parameters, if the blood glucose is dropping rapidly, it'll turn off the insulin and it will give some glucagon. Likewise, if it's rocketing upwards, it'll give more insulin. How aggressive it is at dosing that insulin, of course, is affected by the adaptive parameters that change over time. But even more rapid changes are easily dealt with by the control algorithm. For instance, one of the big challenges with using insulin is that it's absorbed fairly slowly, and people who don't have to use it probably aren't aware of this, but you give insulin and it's given underneath the skin. It has to be absorbed from that space into the bloodstream, and the average time for that insulin to reach its peak blood levels is about 70 minutes. And in some people, it can be much, much longer than that. So there's a long wait to see the effect of a particular insulin dose. And by the same token, if insulin has already been given and circumstances change so that you don't need as much insulin anymore, you're kind of out of luck.
It's true.
You can't take it back. And the only way to deal with that in the past was to take carbohydrates. And, of course, you had to sense that you were low or going low, which not everybody can do mm-hmm. after they've had diabetes for a while, and you had to have carbohydrates available and know to take them. Well, what's nice about the bihormonal approach using glucagon is that it can automatically both turn back the insulin, although that doesn't have as much immediate effect as you would like, but it can also automatically give these microdoses of glucagon, which work even faster than taking oral carbohydrates and can really rescue you in a situation like that where the insulin that was given was right at the time it was given, but then circumstances changed and it wasn't right anymore. Mm-hmm. There's really no other solution for that but to take carbohydrates or use glucagon.
Yeah, I've always had this nightmare that I would take insulin perhaps an hour before lunch and then get in the car and then get in a car accident and then be lying there with 10 units of insulin on board and have no way to tell the paramedics that I'm headed for a much bigger problem than the car accident that I just got into.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a collection of photographs of people's type 1 tattoos. So it's actually surprisingly common for people to get tattoos on their forearms or other prominent, easily seen places so that if they get in a situation like that, the paramedics will think of blood glucose as a problem. It's sort of a morbid, I guess, thing. But I also look at it in the same way that I looked at my grandfather's tattoo. He came back from the Pacific Theater in World War II and had a Navy tattoo. And there was an element of pride in that, you know, that he'd been there, he'd survived, he'd made it. And I think to some degree these diabetes tattoos are the same story, a sense of esprit de corps of people dealing with a really difficult problem and some pride at successfully managing it day to day.
I definitely have had that sense going into well over 22 years now where I'm pretty sure diabetes won't kill me. At this point, when I first was diagnosed, I was like, okay, now I know the thing that will kill me and it's going to kill me slowly. And now 20 years on with no side effects and a low, average glucose, it's pretty clear that I could potentially die of old age. And it's funny to say that, but it's important for a diabetic to feel like, you know, I could die of old age. And that's morbid, but also exactly what I'm supposed to die of.
Right, exactly. You know, and I think even for people like you who do an amazing job of controlling their blood sugar, I think that this has something to offer because, as you mentioned earlier, you spend a lot of time thinking about your diabetes. I don't know what percentage of your brain is constantly thinking about sort of maintaining your health, but it's got to be some significant portion, and one always wonders what additional things you could do if mm-hmm. you didn't have this constant task.
Yeah.
I mentioned to people, you know, what if you had to remember to breathe? I mean, it's not quite that frequent, but, you know, you can't forget to manage your blood glucose if you have type 1 diabetes because you will wind up in trouble so fast. And people who don't have diabetes have a very hard time conceiving of a recurrent task like that that's just relentless and they can never let it slip.
Yeah.
Or disaster will ensue.
It's definitely one of those things where when you meet I've actually met type 1s who live in small towns or don't have another type 1 to hang out with. And when we talk, there's a bonding where their family doesn't really understand. Like even my wife, I've been married to for 15 years, you know, she mostly gets it, but you know, she wasn't awake at 4 a.m. when I had a low. And she was already gone when I woke up with a high because I overshot the low. I woke up, took a bunch of sugar, and then went back to sleep. So last night, even as a good diabetic, was a lousy night. I had a middle of the night down at 40, which is quite low for those who are listening, and then woke up at 200. And all that made me feel was a lot of guilt about what a lousy diabetic I was for that 4-hour period.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. I mean, a lot of people take it on that way. And unfortunately, sometimes physicians encourage that because I think they'll sort of scold people with diabetes if they're not meeting their blood sugar goals, where as if they were some goals that were separate from the person with diabetes themselves. I mean, of course, everyone with diabetes wants to avoid complications, wants to keep their blood sugar under good control. The problem is it's just fiendishly difficult to do. And, you know, in the course of our research, we've discovered even more reasons why it's ridiculously difficult to do. So I mentioned that speed of insulin absorption being so variable from person to person. We found one individual who participated in one of our studies. I said the average time to peak concentrations in blood for Humalog, which is one of the quote-unquote rapid-acting insulins, is 70 minutes in our cohort of patients. Well, in his case, it was 180 minutes.
Mm.
Took over 3 hours.
Yep.
And, you know, that's just impossible to manage your blood glucose when it's absorbed that slowly. You'd have to take your insulin for lunch at breakfast, you know?
Nope. I am one of the two and a half hour people myself, and I know exactly. And actually, we should explain that to the listeners. The analogy that I use, and I'd be interested if you think it's a good one, is the idea of imagine you're trying to fly an airplane from New York to L.A., and you can move the stick, which allows you to go up and down, and you look at the altimeter, and that gives you a sense of, you know, whether you're going to hit the ground or whether you're going to fly away into space. But the trick with diabetes and the trick with flying this particular airplane is that when you look at the altimeter, you're seeing not your current altitude, but your altitude in the past. We call that lag. Maybe you're seeing your altitude 15 minutes ago. And then you push forward on the stick to make a dramatic motion, but it doesn't really do anything and it won't hit until, like in your case, you mentioned 180 minutes. So how do I make a judgment based on data from the past, make a change in my direction, in my altitude, but nothing happens? It's almost like controlling the Mars lander. I push the joystick and then I...
It's worse than that because there's unexpected downdrafts and updrafts trying to change your altitude as well.
Mm.
Other unmeasured things, you know, that can dramatically affect it. So, for instance, physical exercise, even very moderate physical exercise, can cause dramatic drops in the blood glucose because the muscles take up glucose as energy, mm-hmm. and they are not dependent on insulin to do that. So that's another variable that comes into play, that it's as if you have all these other players trying to move the stick in different directions, and you're still trying to make all the corrections for all that stuff. It's really tricky, but even worse than that, sometimes exercise makes your blood glucose go up, and it depends on the balance of that glucose uptake in the muscle versus the catecholamines, the epinephrine, norepinephrine, fight or flight. So people in competition, blood glucose usually goes up, or people exercising very hard, their blood glucose typically goes up.
Mm-hmm.
But moderate exercise, it tends to go down. And there's innumerable other things, like how fast your food is absorbed and so forth, that makes it really just absurdly difficult if you only get to make a few adjustments on that altimeter stick a day. And that's basically what people do. You know, they if they get really good control, often they check and make some adjustment up to 10 times a day. But what this system does, the bionic pancreas does, is it makes an adjustment 288 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to invest a lot less in each of those decisions, and you have a lot of opportunities to correct things if they didn't go as you planned, or if there's some unmeasured variable that comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And so the amount of insulin you gave didn't have the expected effect. Well, the system knows that and can make a further adjustment, and you don't have to pay any attention to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. So let's dig into that a little bit. Right now, I have a pump with one thing in it, which is insulin, and I can either eat to make my blood sugar go up or add insulin to bring it down. And unfortunately, if I have a lot of lows, I can actually gain a lot of weight. I see a number of people who gained weight, which causes problems with their diabetes because the only way they can bring their blood sugar up is by eating more. And it's surprising how you can put another 600 to 800 calories in your head just because you're trying to get out of low blood sugars. What this adds is glucagon, which in my experience is one of those things that you keep in the fridge in an emergency. It's a big shot, like in Pulp Fiction, where someone's on the ground and they have low blood sugar. Get the glucagon, and we bring them back to life. You're putting glucagon in another pump, a parallel chamber, as it were, and
right.
delivering that a little bit at a time.
And using much smaller doses, that's right. So glucagon currently is used, as you mentioned, as a rescue for such a severe hypoglycemia that the person is unable to even eat, unable to take carbs into their mouth with assistance. So they're unconscious, and the only way to bring them up is to either give them an IV of glucose, which isn't always available,
mm-hmm.
or to use this glucagon. And what the glucagon does, it acts on the liver. When you eat a meal, the liver stores the sugar that you eat in the form of a polymer called glycogen. Just strings a bunch of sugar molecules together in this branching polymer and stores it in the liver. So you can actually store a tremendous amount of glucose in the liver. And normally what happens if the pancreas is working right is that when the blood glucose starts to fall because you're using up glucose and there's no additional glucose coming from the gut, this glucagon is released and it liberates that sugar from the liver. It breaks down that polymer, that carbohydrate polymer called glycogen, and releases that sugar into the bloodstream. And in the huge, massive dose that you take in the case of severe or low, the idea is to get as much glucose into the bloodstream as possible so the person can wake up and then take some carbohydrates. Unfortunately, a side effect of these very high doses of glucagon is often nausea and vomiting. So it's a tremendously unpleasant experience to get to the point of being, one, unconscious from hypoglycemia, and then being woken up by a drug that makes you intensely nauseated.
Mm.
Not a nice thing. However, what we do is we give very tiny doses of glucagon, more consistent with the normal doses that the pancreas would have given if it were able to do so. And we try and prevent those lows from ever happening by just giving a little nudge. If the blood glucose starts to dip, we just give a little bit of glucagon and nudge it back up again.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's dropping fast, we may give even larger amounts, but still quite small compared to the rescue dose. The largest dose our system can give at any one time is 8% of that full rescue dose of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I should mention is that everybody who has type 1 knows, and most people who understand something about type 1 know, that the reason you have type 1 in the first place is that your immune system went off kilter and attacked your beta cells, the mm-hmm. insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. But what is less commonly appreciated is that once that happens, the alpha cells that make the glucagon, for reasons we don't fully understand, stop working right as well. Even though they're not destroyed, even though they're still there, they no longer release glucagon in response to low blood sugars. And so what's missing in type 1 is not just the insulin, it's also the glucagon. And that leaves people with type 1 very vulnerable to low blood sugars. And what we're trying to do is replace both of those functions, not just the insulin function, but the glucagon function as well.
And aren't there are other hormones, is not amylin and a couple of other things. Diabetes isn't just the removal of one hormone in your system.
That's right. So the two that are probably by far the most important are the insulin and the glucagon. Mm-hmm. But there is also amylin, which is released every time insulin is released. It's in the same granules. And so when the cells release insulin, they release amylin. There's still some debate about whether amylin has benefits in and of itself, independent of insulin. But there is a company that is trying to replace amylin as well, with the idea that that may reduce some diabetes complications. I'm not 100% convinced of that, and I think there's still more work to do to know whether that's the case or not. But clearly, the lack of insulin and the lack of proper regulation of glucagon are primarily responsible for the difficulty in controlling blood sugars in type 1.
Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform. So you're using glucagon, using our airplane analogy, in that you'll use the CGM to detect that the airplane is losing altitude quickly, and the glucagon is the pull up that allows you to dramatically and quickly level the plane out and make sure that it doesn't crash into the ground. Wouldn't that?
That's right. And the nice thing about the glucagon is that it's absorbed much faster than insulin.
Hmm.
So whereas insulin has this problem that once you give it, absorbed very slowly and then it clears very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Glucagon is absorbed much faster. It has an average time to peak levels in blood of about 15 to 20 minutes.
Mm.
And so it's extraordinarily fast compared to insulin, which is pretty important if you're going to use it in that capacity of interrupting a drop in blood glucose.
Mm-hmm. It seemed like, and again, speaking as a layman, looking at some of the appendices, and of course, people can go up and look in the show notes and explore the entire study as well as the appendices, that some of the graphs looked to me as a layman in that the bionic pancreas would put quite a lot of insulin into the system in response to a high, bring the sugar down quite quickly, and then bolus a, glucagon. That would cause someone to use a lot more insulin in over the course of a day than I use.
You know, it's interesting that we really didn't see that. So the clearest data for that is in the kids. So in the pediatric study, which involved adolescents, the kids served as their own controls. So they had a control period and then they had a bionic pancreas period. And the reason I'm going to focus on that one first is because they ate the same meals during the two arms of the studies. And we could confirm that they really did. They had the same number of carbohydrates. And so the bionic pancreas lowered their average blood glucose, and it reduced the amount of hypoglycemia they had and the number of times they had to take carbohydrates. But it didn't change the amount of insulin they used. So you can certainly point to places where it looks like that, you know, had we been able to more finely calibrate the insulin, we could have used a little bit less, and then we wouldn't have had to use as much glucagon. And I certainly see those places as well. On average, the kids didn't actually use any more insulin, even though we lowered their blood glucose.
So that depends on the person?
Well,
because according to the appendices indicated that 11 of the patients used 50% more insulin during the bionic
pancreas. That was in the adult study. So I'll move on to the adult study next. So in the adult study, what we found is that in about half of the subjects had an average blood glucose during the usual care arm that was well controlled. They had an average that would have given them an A1C less than 7%, and half had an average that would be above that point. The people who, under usual care, had well-controlled blood glucose also had well-controlled blood glucose with the bionic pancreas, and they didn't use any different amount of insulin between arms. The people who had high average blood sugars under usual care had a much more dramatic lowering of their average blood glucose than the cohort as a whole, of course, because you know, the average went down, and if you were already low, you didn't change much. So they were responsible for most of the drop in the blood glucose. And they did, in fact, use more insulin. But one could argue that they just weren't using enough to begin with because they had high blood glucoses. The other thing that we didn't really emphasize in the paper, we also looked at the carbohydrate intake of the adults. And we weren't quite as confident in our measurements there. We were very confident in how many grams of carbohydrates they ate a day during the bionic pancreas period because we documented that ourselves. They, you know, they had a nurse with them, and so we took pictures of their meals, and we know that we didn't miss any. And we know that under those circumstances, they ate about 150 grams of carbohydrate a day on average. We also had them document with a camera and some note-taking how many carbs they ate at home. And based on those records, they ate an average of 100 grams of carbohydrates a day at home. So that would say they ate 50% more carbs on the bionic pancreas. And that would be pretty consistent with what they told us anecdotally. They said, well, you know, I went out to the North End when I was on the bionic pancreas, and I had this huge plate of pasta, and I never would have done that if I wasn't on the bionic pancreas. So we think that part of that increased insulin usage may also be due to the fact that they ate a lot more carbs on the bionic pancreas arm. But we weren't 100% sure that they hadn't missed anything when they were at home, so we didn't want to make a quantitative statement. So it could be that it was less than a 50% increase, but we know that there was an increase in the amount of carbs on the bionic pancreas arm, and that could also have accounted for part of the increase in insulin usage, especially in people who had high blood sugars on the usual care.
That makes sense. I mean, people aren't lying in bed for a week on the pancreas. They're living their lives and they're trying things out. And I'm sure I would go and have pizza and ice cream if I was on a bionic pancreas as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one woman was tweeting, you know, and blogging during it. And she's like, I just had 9 bowls of ice cream for dessert. Like, well, Okay.
Not the behavior we're trying to promote.
Yeah, exactly. You should keep in mind that this having type 1 will not protect you from also getting type 2, but, you know, I think that, you know, as time went on, people would get over that new car, you know, sort of sense of, let me go out and race this thing 150 miles an hour on the freeway, and they would settle back into their lives. But, and I think this will become more clear as we do much longer studies.
Mm-hmm. What do you and the team think about some of the excitement around do-it-yourself systems like the DIY pancreas or projects like Night Scout, where they're taking continuous glucose meters and projecting their data into the cloud? These are systems that do not have the bi-hormonal option. They don't have dual pumping, but they're getting some pretty amazing results without the glucagon pull-up option.
So are these groups that are hacking their pumps as well, so that they or are they just doing the monitor, you know, like remote monitoring of kids and getting the CGM data to the parents?
Some are hacking their pumps. The beginning of them is the math, doing the algorithm. So, for example, DIY pancreas system has two CGMs. The one is enclosed in a box with a cell phone, similar to the Bionic Pancreas. It sends it up to the cloud for analysis, and then it recommends a bolus, and then the individual has to go and make that final decision as opposed to
so
an automatic.
Like a decision support tool. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and one individual has seen A1Cs drop, you know, a percent and a half, so going from 7.5 down to 6. And they're doing this without glucagon. So my question is, you know, do you anticipate that an artificial pancreas could be in any way successful, or the algorithm could work if you de-emphasized the glucagon?
Well, there are certainly groups out there working on artificial pancreas systems that don't use glucagon. And we think they probably could do better, and they've shown they can do much better than usual care using just modulation of the insulin. So you can reduce the amount of hypoglycemia, you can improve the time in range, and reduce the average blood glucose. So I don't think that you absolutely need glucagon to improve on the current standard of care, but that's in large part because the current standard of care for many people isn't very good. If you look at the average A1C in the U.S. population for adults, it's somewhere between 8 and 8.5%. So I think that many of these systems will dramatically improve on that. We're trying to develop something that will really almost completely lift the burden of diabetes, reduce the amount that people have to do, fully automate blood glucose control. And we think the only way you can really automate blood glucose control is to have a way to raise the blood glucose without having to take carbs. Mm-hmm. But I think that you could certainly get improvements using insulin-only systems. We're just trying to go a step beyond what is probably achievable with insulin-only based systems. And the other thing that's important to note is that you can always lower the average. The question is, can you lower the average without increasing the amount of hypoglycemia and or even reducing the amount of hypoglycemia? And I think it's our goal to bring everybody into a average blood glucose range that would give them A1Cs less than 7% or less than 6.5%, but at the same time reduce the amount of hypoglycemia to a very, very low level and completely eliminate dangerous hypoglycemia. That's the goal. And because there are elements of glucose regulation which are independent of insulin, we don't think that you can really optimally reduce hypoglycemia without the glucagon. So, for instance, exercise is an Achilles heel for any insulin-dependent system. If you have unplanned exercise that you don't plan for an hour in advance by reducing your basal rate, and you go into that exercise with the blood glucose in target range, you are going to go low, almost inevitably.
Right. The system that you have right now is kind of a proof of concept, and I'm saying this is my words. I see, you know, two pumps and a system wrapped around an iPhone and a CGM. It's a lot of moving parts. Do you anticipate that there's going to be a future where it really is kind of an integrated device, a dual chambered pump, an integrated brain? You're using the iPhone in this case as the easy to program algorithm maker. Right. But I presume that the dream is a pump sized dual chambered device that I keep in my pocket and I don't think about.
That's correct. And in fact, my colleagues, Ed and Faraz, are working with some industrial partners to build exactly that device now. And the thought is that the first generation device will not be, you know, reach maximum miniaturization, but it will be about the size of an iPhone and about twice as thick. So a little larger than a current insulin pump, but mm-hmm. certainly possible to put it in your pocket or clip it on a belt. And that would have the two pump chambers, it would have the CGM receiver, it would have all the logic for the algorithm, and it would have a display screen so you could see what your blood glucose was doing and what the algorithm was doing in terms of dosing of insulin and glucagon, and then also a way to interact with the device to, for instance, announce meals if you chose to do that mm-hmm. or to use some of the other features that we've now built in. So, for instance, a new feature in the system that we're using in our current study is that the user can choose the target. They can decide to raise the target blood glucose of the device by up to 30 milligrams per deciliter. And so in all of our current and all of our previous studies, the target was 100 milligrams per deciliter. The system didn't achieve that, but that was the target. And there were people that had very low average blood glucoses. You know, I think our lowest was 109 milligrams per deciliter over 5 days. There is probably no reason to have an average blood glucose that low.
Even though that's what a normal person has or lower.
Yeah, that's right. If you look at data on, you know, from these interventional trials, it looks like if you get below an average blood glucose of 140 or 150, there's almost no detectable signal for increased eye complications, for instance. There is an interesting experiment of nature in people who have mutations in one of the genes that is responsible for bringing glucose into the cell, and it affects the beta cells of the pancreas so that, in essence, it changes their set point for insulin secretion. And those people, from birth, have an average blood glucose of 150.
Really?
But a well-controlled average blood glucose. In other words, they regulate to that target just like people without diabetes regulate to the target of about 90 or 80, and they have no diabetes complications whatsoever.
So that implies that it is the dramatic variance and the roller coaster that hurts us as much as it is the high average blood sugar.
Well, actually, no. I think from the studies that are out there that most of it is because most people have an average that's above 150.
Ah.
So the recommendation of the American Diabetes Association is to aim for an A1C, which is this measure of your average blood glucose over 3 months, of less than 7%. That is equivalent to an average blood glucose of 154. Mm-hmm. So the reason for that recommendation is that it was found in the landmark DCCT, or Diabetes Control and Complications trial, that if you kept the average blood glucose below that point, you dramatically reduce the incidence of complications and the progression of complications that had already started. So we don't think it's necessary to get down to normal blood glucoses to almost entirely eliminate the risk of complications. And it's easier to achieve an average blood glucose of, say, 140 without hypoglycemia than it is to achieve an average blood glucose of 110 without hypoglycemia. So the reason we put this feature in is if somebody was, say, getting an average blood glucose on the device, the adaptation of the device wound up settling with an average glucose of, say, 110, but they were spending 5% of their time with a CGM glucose less than 60. Mm-hmm. Well, they could say, you know what? I don't want to be 110. I want to be 130 and have less than 1% of my time hypoglycemic. Now they have the flexibility to do that. So it's sort of an additional level of control on top of the adaptation that the algorithm automatically does.
And that'll be great for kids as well. We usually recommend that kids under, you know, 15 try to stay around 150. Well, kind of an uptight programmer type like myself might want to aim for 110, and now we would have that that flexibility. I have found, though, that my CGM changes its values depending on positioning. I'll find that it might think that I'm 60 while I'm sleeping, and then when I wake up and the interstitial fluids in my body start to come together, as well as the, just the general dawn effect in waking up, I can see very dramatic numbers. All of this hinges on the accuracy of the CGM, doesn't it?
It does, and that's why when we chose the CGM we were going to use, we actually put a lot of work into that. We did two separate studies, both of which are available on our website, where we tested all the currently available continuous glucose monitoring devices head-to-head-to-head against each other. Mm-hmm. And we chose the one that for each of the phases of our study that was the most accurate at the time that we did those comparisons. And so currently we're using a device from Dexcom called the Dexcom G4 Platinum, which is much more accurate than the other currently available CGM device in the U.S., which is made by Medtronic, and it's called the the Enlite sensor. It's associated with their 530G pump. And turns out the error of the Medtronic device is almost twice as large as the Dexcom device. So we went with the Dexcom device, and we hope that both of those companies continue to innovate and make better products, and they both say they've got better accuracy in the future. Mm-hmm. So we picked the best device we could pick. We also came up with some rules about calibrating that device, because the calibrations are key. So for instance, we ask people not to calibrate in the immediate aftermath of eating, because that's a time when the blood glucose and the CGM glucose can vary the most. We know when there's a rapid rise, for instance, in blood glucose, it can be in a little while before the interstitial fluid catches up. That lag varies a bit, but on average it's about 7 minutes for the Dexcom, which isn't too bad. But if your blood glucose is rising fast, it can really amount to a lot. I mean, if your blood glucose is rising at, say, 3 mg/dL/min, a 7 minute lag is over 20 mg/dL offset. So yeah, you don't want to be calibrating at those times. And we also ask people not to calibrate in the immediate aftermath of glucagon doses for exactly the same reason, because they can cause rapid rises in blood glucose, and it can take a while for the interstitial fluid that is what the CGM measures to catch up. So we go out of our way to try and have the most accurate device. And then we also have built in elements of the algorithm to try and compensate to some degree for that lag. So for instance, if the blood glucose is falling very fast, we might step in by reducing insulin dosing and treating with glucagon when the blood glucose is still relatively high as 180 mg/dL if it's dropping fast enough, because we know that the true blood glucose is lower than that by some increment, which again depends on the rate of fall. So the derivative of the change in of the blood glucose with respect to time is an important variable in the way the algorithm operates. But as you point out, if the CGM is just flat out inaccurate, then the algorithm, knowing only what the CGM is telling it, could also be making incorrect decisions. I will point out, you mentioned at night, there is a specific problem at night that we know of. And that is, if the sensor is at a place where there is pressure on the sensor, what happens is that seems to squeeze the interstitial fluid out from around where the sensor tip is,
yes,
and there's a characteristic under-reading of the blood glucose. In other words, it underestimates what the blood glucose is, presumably because that area isn't being perfused very well, and the glucose that's in that interstitial fluid is getting used up. The good news, at least for that particular artifact, is that it's a conservative one. It will only cause the device to try and drive the blood glucose up, which is a safer thing to do than, you know, if it drives it up higher than you'd like because it was underestimating the blood glucose, that's safer than the reverse, which is really dangerous. If the CGM is overestimating the blood glucose and the system is dosing insulin for that, that's a truly dangerous situation. And fortunately, we don't know of a specific situation that causes that artifact.
That's true. Yeah. I've only had it lie to me about being high once or twice in a year.
And usually it's when there's pressure on the sensor. And so if you can put it in places that avoid that, that's a big help. The other place where it will lie to you about being high, at least in theory, is if you take large doses of Tylenol or acetaminophen. Mm. And the degree to which this is a problem is debated to some degree, but two of the sensors on the market in the U.S., both the Dexcom and the Medtronic devices, are sensitive to at least very high levels of acetaminophen, and they will cause it to overread the glucose. So we always recommend that people not take Tylenol and take, say, ibuprofen instead if they use a continuous glucose monitor. The late lamented Abbott Navigator, which Abbott pulled off the market very unfortunately, was not sensitive to acetaminophen. And it's for sale in Europe right now, but not in the U.S., unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that's a small price to pay, though, I think, for better blood sugar. I hope that something like this is available soon. As someone who's been diabetic for going on my third decade, it has always been 5 years out of reach. We always joke about that as diabetics, that just another 5 years and we'll have this handled. But it's nice to see us moving forward, and maybe you can promise me in 5 years it'll be even better.
Well, we like to avoid the five-year curse that you talk about. My collaborator talks about 5 years as being the minimum amount of unaccountable time. In other words, you can always say it's 5 years, and no one could ever sort of prove you wrong in a time scale that matters. But we, knowing that, have tried to be much more specific about our timeline, and now we're talking in terms of months rather than years. And his goal has always been to get it ready for when his son goes to college, which at this point is, I believe, 38 months in the future. And oh, wow. we have a timeline laid out that can get us there as long as we can continue to push forward. Right now, we've had very good luck at getting resources to do clinical trials, but one thing that's been much harder is to get resources to do the technology development. And I told you that we were working on building this fully integrated system, and mm-hmm. right now that is a resource limited thing. So we're hoping that we get enough resources so that we can stay on this timeline, and as long as we are able to do that in the next 6 months or so, then we'll be able to stay on our timeline to get something in front of the FDA in early 2017. And if we can do that, then we could potentially have approval of a device by the end of 2017, which is less than 5 years away.
Well, that is exactly what I like to hear, and very, very exciting. And folks who are listening can go and look at www.bionicpancreas.org and learn all about this stuff. It's a very, very exciting time to be a technologist, and I'm looking forward to dying of old age and not of diabetes, and I thank you for all of your work.
Yes, something to look forward to.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stephen J. Russell. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.